This is Digital Music Trends 145, recorded on the 15th of August 2013, a best-of show covering the episodes from January to July. Hello everyone, and welcome to this Digital Music Trends best-of show covering the year so far. There's been lots to report almost every single week this year, and so it's been quite hard to condense it all into one single show, even if it did turn out to be pretty long at just over 2 hours. But what I attempted to do is reconstructing the timeline of some of the biggest news that we covered over the last few months, including Beats Daisy, the MySpace relaunch, Google Play Music All Access, Twitter Music, Spotify, iTunes Radio, and Jay-Z's Magna Carta Holy Grail. So I really hope you enjoy this best of show, and I hope you'll tune back in next week for the usual DMT news show. And I reckon that I'm gonna have to start recording one of these best of shows every 4 or 5 months, actually, because there was a lot of great material that I had to leave out, and also I couldn't include any of the interviews that I recorded at events, including South by Southwest, Ames Music Connected, Medium, the World Creator Summit, and more. And so I'm probably gonna compile a best of show to appear later on in the year for those. I'm actually lining up guests all the way up to December, and I'm really excited about the great people that I've managed to get in the calendar so far. So please keep on watching or listening, and make sure that you, if you enjoy the show, you pass it on to at least one person today. That would be amazingly helpful, as you probably realize that this is quite a niche show, and so the more people know about it, the better. And we start with a review of the news surrounding the upcoming launch of Beats Daisy Music Streaming Service, which started in January on DMT 116 with David Emery, Duncan Geer, and Will Mills. First thing, big news of last week. It was all over Twitter, as all the big news, of course. It was the announcement of Beats by Dre that announced the new project Daisy. So the announcement came with the news that Topspin CEO Ian Rogers is transitioning to become the CEO of this newly formed entity, as well as the CEO of Mog. So Daisy will actually be built on top of Mog, a streaming service that Beats acquired last year. But Topspin fans shouldn't fear, because the platform will actually be expanded and will receive substantial investment from Beats as well. So there's a good chance actually there's going to be some sort of collaboration between Daisy and Topspin in the future. So guys, first of all, let's talk personalities. This creates a very interesting executive group with Ian Rogers as CEO and Trent Reznor as Chief Creative Officer. So, Will, what do you think these two guys can bring to a streaming service?
Yeah, obviously it's a great news for Daisy and the service. Ian's obviously a very experienced digital music guy. I think just in general, Jimmy Iovine and Dre, they pulled off something very significant with the Beats headphones, which was making a real niche product, which is a $300 pair of headphones, into something that's very desirable and a mass consumer product. So I think collectively that those guys with Ian and Trent, it's going to be, interesting to see what they bring from the kind of artist side. Yeah. Streaming, obviously, paid for streaming is still a niche service, much like, very expensive headphones were. So obviously got a great track record in doing that. However, unlike premium headphones, they're not coming into this market, as the only game in town. Spotify have been around a long time, RDO well-funded, Deezer likewise, and Rhapsody, etc. So there's a lot of players already here. A lot of them are making a pretty decent effort at curation, whether that's via Spotify's apps, the deep Facebook integration all of these services have got. So I think it's not going to be, easy, but it's always exciting to see another entrant, especially one with such a combined array of talent that Daisy are going to be bringing to the table. So it's going to be exciting to watch.
Yeah, and Duncan, like from a technology standpoint, what do you reckon is, there's almost like a bit of a standoff between Spotify, which is very much tech-driven, and Daisy, which we should have much more of an artist-driven perspective, and of course with Ian and Trent being on board as executives. How do you see that panning out?
Well, I think Spotify would probably disagree that they don't have an artist-driven perspective. Yeah. But I do take your point. They very much started out almost as a technology company, doing stuff with music. I think what's going to be interesting to see is how it works on a functional level, what the experience is like for the consumer, because that's going to be absolutely key as to whether this dies on the vine like absolutely every other streaming service has so far that isn't Spotify, or whether it can actually compete. And it is entirely possible that it's going to be different around the world. I mean, I'm based in Sweden, and Spotify is absolutely everywhere. There's nobody who doesn't use Spotify here. It's huge. And so probably their chances of penetration here, unless they do something very spectacular, is pretty small. But America is still a relatively untapped market, and that seems to be very much where they're hitting first, even though they've said they've got global ambitions. Yeah. I reckon that they've got more of a chance in America than anywhere else.
Yeah, and David, let's look at it from a label standpoint. You know, what do you think this executive team can bring to the table in terms of helping labels expose their artists, maybe more so than other streaming services have done in the past?
I mean, it's kind of tricky because obviously at the moment we're talking about something that doesn't exist. I mean, kind of who knows, really? Obviously, yeah. Topspin have done a lot, but really, you know, Topspin's business was aimed at artists and managers, not labels. So from my point of view, it's kind of, you know, not really coming from that point. I mean, they've talked a lot about how artist friendly they're going to be or want to be, but they haven't talked about in any specific what that actually means. So who knows? Like, you know, a lot of like the controversy that surrounds Spotify, which personally I think is completely unfounded, but yeah, neither here nor there, is how much they pay to artists.
Yeah.
And I don't see like how these guys are going to change that, because I think it's a relatively established thing. So okay, so it's not in terms of payment; it's in terms of what then? Like, what are they? What new are they bringing to this table? They have a great team of people that are doing really good at talking. Like, they have a great hype crew, basically, is what they've assembled. Like, you know, no disrespect to that. Like, you know, people like Ian and Trent, obviously, are really, really good at talking about technology and music.
Yeah.
But there's still so much that needs to be kind of proven with what they're doing. Like, you know, Mog as a Service was, like, fine, but really kind of didn't. You know, it wasn't a successful service. Yeah. So it's right, okay, so that's, you know, if we strip all of the hype, like, away, right, that's the starting point. Like, we've got Mog and we've got some aspects of Topspin. Those two things put together don't excite me. So what more are they going to add to it that makes this a really interesting proposition? And I think there's still so many questions left. Yeah. Not even unanswered, but not even, like, asked yet.
Absolutely. And here, another segment on Daisy's funding round, this time from DMT 123, with Sid Lawrence and Karim Fanouz. First up, Beats Audio appears to have closed a round of funding targeted towards the development of Daisy. So this round is valued at around $60 million, and it's led by billionaire Len Blavatnik. And his company Access Industries. So the company is really invested in the music space since they actually own Warner Music. So it can be more invested than that, really. And you know, they acquired that for $3.3 billion in 2011. There's a number of other investors involved, of course, but Access Industries seems to be the leading investor for this round. So the other interesting thing is that Beats will not be remaining Daisy will not be remaining under Beats' wings for long. It looks like the company will be spun off later this year once it launches. And so first of all, some thoughts on this round. It's a very big round for a company that has just basically announced its service. It hasn't even, you know, released anything or shown what it's going to do. So Karim, is it a too big a round, or do you think it's what the company needs to actually enter this market with a bang and try and get some market share?
Well, I think if we look at the other big investments recently, so we've seen $130 million in Deezer and $100 million in Spotify, so it's smaller than that. There's going to be an almighty royale in the next few years to dominate the mainstream landscapes. So I think services do need as much as they can get to achieve scale quickly, and it's up against those other big guys. So I think, you know, it is a significant round of funding, but the more the better, really. I thought another interesting thing about all of this, well, I wondered whether spinning off from Daisy would be a problem for it, because I really like the close alignment with the Beats brand and the potential to bundle in with headphones and things like that. But what they're saying, you know, that shouldn't be lost. And the other interesting thing about it is that, you know, someone who's got a label has a stake now in Deezer and also has a stake in the new Daisy service. And I think that's quite interesting strategic
strategically. So yeah, those are my thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. And Sid, from your side, you know, Daisy comes out of the gates with a huge round of funding, you know, without having gone through the first, you know, of course it has gone through a first huge development with Mog, because that's going to be built on top of Mog, but it's essentially going to be a separate service. So do you reckon that, you know, this kind of money is going to be targeted especially towards the development of the platform, or is going to be used for marketing purposes, or what do you reckon about that?
Well, I hope it's not for the development of the platform. I would hope it was for marketing. Because, yeah. I mean, if you were to give me that amount of money, I'm pretty certain we could make something pretty good.
awesome.
yeah. I mean, you definitely, it's always a case of the more money you've got to spend on marketing, the better you're going to do, right?
Yeah.
Like, you, with decent marketing, you can sell ice to an Eskimo. So, I mean, yeah, as long as they put it towards marketing and they don't just spunk it up the wall, then I think it's got a good chance of doing well. It's definitely going to do well amongst the kids with the Beats brand.
Yeah.
With, like, I mean, how many teenagers do you see wearing Beats headphones? Like, you see more people wearing Beats headphones than you do seeing wearing them wearing iPhone headphones, right?
Yeah, sure.
And, I mean, that was a big time when everyone had these white headphones. So, I mean, yeah, I think it's definitely got a chance. Whether we need yet another streaming service is to be decided and to be seen. But I think it's got a good chance amongst the kids. I think that's where the main market will be, the teenagers, the ones who are currently using YouTube.
Yeah.
But we'll see, because obviously with Google and YouTube potentially going into a subscription service or potentially going into a bigger streaming service, it will be interesting to see how it all pans out.
And on DMT 140, we chat about Daisy's rumored partnership with AT&T with Steve Knopper, Sitar Telly, and Nicke Osterbach. That we haven't talked about in a few weeks on the show, actually, because they've kind of gone quiet since announcing that the service was going to happen a few months ago. The service is due to start, operating probably in Q3, Q4 of this year. The company, of course, is backed by Jimmy Iovine from Beats by Dr. Dre, and is looking, apparently, to strike a deal with a mobile carrier. So that makes a lot of sense. AT&T, apparently, is in the picture. And this would allow the service to ramp up its user base super quickly without having to go through, you know, millions of dollars of marketing spend or doing too much work on that front, because, of course, AT&T would grant them a huge user base from the get-go. So, first of all, where do you see Daisy being in terms of negotiating position? Like, do you think that AT&T has got a stronger position in the sense that it can offer Daisy this huge platform, or does the association with Beats by Dr. Dre actually, or is that strong enough by itself to actually carry the service and help it strike a decent deal with one of these operators? Steve, what's your take on that from a US perspective?
I feel like AT&T could walk away from this deal easier than Daisy and Beats could. I mean, I unless I'm missing something, like obviously, you know, Beats has been a very successful company. The people behind it, Jimmy Iovine and Ian Rogers, really good people. And you know, I imagine that when their service finally does roll out, it'll be something interesting, something cool. But right now, it's just sort of hard to conceptualize. There's so many really strong players in the space. You know, why would I want to do Beats's streaming service when I have Spotify or Mog or RDO or Songs or, you know, whatever else it is, plus buying stuff on iTunes? It just seems crowded.
Yeah.
So I guess that'd be my feeling about it. I feel like it would be a hard sell to take this sort of vague, yeah, we're going to do this great service kind of thing to a major company like AT&T. However, I'm not privy to all the details, I'm sure, and Jimmy Iovine is a much better and more experienced deal maker than I am. So,
yeah, sure. Nicke, looking at this potential deal, you know, we look back at what has happened in the streaming space to other companies like Spotify, for example, which has made successful deals, for example, in Germany with the carrier there and a few other countries, but it hasn't really managed to land a major carrier deal in the US. And some blame it on the fact that it's, you know, a brand recognition problem, because Spotify is still in its, you know, it's growing, but it's still not a major company in terms of being recognizable. How do you feel about AT&T choosing a newcomer like Daisy instead of somebody like Spotify in the US to come into the market with a streaming service offering?
Yeah, well, I think, like, from my point of view, when
when Beats and those guys, like when they bought MLG, didn't have any technology that was superior to their competitors, was basically falling back with the race.
Yeah.
And now, like since Jimmy Iovino, however you say his name, he got in board. Like, there's been a very good PR effort on, like, you know, how Daisy will be this, you know, like direct to fan kind of different version, and kind of a more the kind of a topspin angle of how you're connecting the fans direct to the streaming space. Yeah. But like, so far we haven't seen any features that would, like, you know, put them ahead of their competition. I think, like, something they've emphasized a lot is curation and the importance of curation. But then also I would argue that, like, you know, if you're trying to build a global service, how do you do curation? Yeah. Wouldn't you then need some kind of mechanical curation with human curation? And then that being said, Spotify's kind of recommendation features are actually pretty good. And I think, like, you know, they have a lot of work to do to be able to compete with Spotify and RDO.
Absolutely.
And currently they're falling behind, and there's just this big promise of, like, this new service. But a lot of the hype comes from, like, the people involved. So I think, like, they have to deliver on, you know, what they're promising.
Yeah.
And, hopefully we're going to see something concrete soon and not just talk.
Exactly. And Sitar, that makes a really good point, because you've worked with a lot of early stage companies and saw them through to launch. And so how do you feel about the tactic of hyping up the company so much from the get-go? Is it incredibly dangerous to create the image of this, like, really cool new layout, new way of offering the music catalog type idea when we don't really know if the company is going to be able to deliver? And if it can't deliver to the standard that it promised, then it's going to be seen as a failure, even if it is a decent service.
I usually find that tactic fairly dangerous. And I don't know that there's a lot of benefit to it, although I think Topspin, Ian's previous company, took the same route.
Yeah.
And again, I think it was a dangerous route for them because they ended up under-delivering a lot initially, especially on the self-service marketing bit of it. So I'm surprised they went down the same route again. Then again, with the people involved, I'm not sure you could have done this in a stealth manner.
Yeah.
You know, there's some pretty big names, so I'm not sure they had a choice about it. Also, I think, you know, the Beats, it is quite a good technical product, the headphones, but it's also brilliant marketing.
Yeah.
And I don't know that they would have chosen any other route. And then in terms of whether there's really an opportunity for them, you know, if you were to say all people want is just access to all music, then I would say no, because I think you can already get that. Not even on Spotify, frankly, most people get it on YouTube. Yeah. Which is the single biggest music provider in the world. But actually, the problem isn't that. The problem is one of user experience. And the Spotify user experience hasn't changed in about 5 years. You know, it's an incredibly dated user experience. And some of the stuff they've released recently, especially with Discovery, I think is moving in the right direction.
Yeah.
But if Daisy has any opportunity, it'll be, I think, in providing just a much better user experience for people, particularly around playlisting, which is, I think, an area where Spotify just hasn't done nearly as much as they could have.
And the relaunch of MySpace was another big story for the first half of 2013, attracting interest and criticism. And we start with the announcement in DMT 117 with Stuart Radge and Darren Hemmings. I think we should get started right away by talking about the public launch of MySpace, which coincided with Justin Timberlake releasing his first solo track since 2006 called Suit and Tie. So you couldn't really have escaped it. It was everywhere, and it was plastered all over MySpace. I mean, the track was as well. And so I wanted to ask you guys what your impressions of MySpace are at this point, now that the site has gone public. I know you probably both had access to the beta version of the site for 2 or 3 months already, so you probably have a more rounded opinion of what the site is all about. So Darren, what's your thoughts first? Because I know that you had some early insights into the site, and now yeah. what's your opinion?
Just really that I'm not seeing it catch a wave at the moment. You know, I think it's interesting. I mean, I think there's a number of issues around MySpace with, you know, the design of it and various other things see it kind of falling short In that, you know, you've seen a lot of coverage of people are basically saying, I don't really know what I'm going to be doing on there, and I don't know what these sort of two circles that turn into one are supposed to actually mean, and all these kinds of things. But I think, you know, you could, I would quite happily level similar kind of design criticisms at something like Spotify.
Yeah.
You know, I quite like RDO, and the reason I like it is because I just feel it's a better designed interface, you know. And I think with MySpace, those design shortfalls could be forgiven were it catching a huge wave of interest and excitement. You know, and I think Spotify ultimately will sort themselves out in my case and fix their whole user interface so that it's much nicer, you know. And they've already hinted at it with various things. And I think MySpace has the potential to do the same if it only caught that wave of interest that you get from users all going, oh, have you tried it and everything else. Unfortunately, it seems to have fallen short. And
yeah.
I think with only, genuinely, I've only seen one article that actually gave them a break. Every single article I've read outside of that, which is quite a few, is kind of beating them up, you know. So not so good. And I think there's also an issue there, which we could probably come on to, but, you know, around the fact they've launched it with Timberlake and then simultaneously not a week later had a story break about this problem with Merlin and the indies.
Absolutely, yeah.
Kind of amounts, you know, as someone from my side working a lot with independent labels, obviously, to be quite a massive PR backfire.
Yeah. Stuart?
Win over.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And Stuart, what's your thoughts on the general sort of design of the service and its potential user base as well?
Yeah, well, it's because I've been using it for a couple of months as a beta, and it looks, on first glance, it looks really nice and it looks very slick, and it looks like it's been inspired by tablet sign. You can imagine it working lovely on a touchscreen. On a desktop, it's a bit weird because you're kind of scrolling sideways. And,
yeah.
But the big place it's falling down for the moment with me is I don't have many friends on there. And it's a social music site, and if you have it bustling with your friends who are all playing songs and discovering stuff, it's marvelous. If you don't, it's kind of bit of a wasteland. And I've also had that thing that reminds me of the old MySpace where rubbish bands have started adding me as a friend or connecting to me, which is the new thing. And all these bands I'd never heard of who were rubbish. Really, like, you listen to them and they're awful. And kind of just going and literally connecting to anyone they can find on there, hoping to get connection back. So that's not so good. I don't know. I mean, I sort of, thinking about my use of those social, I mean, Facebook and Twitter are my social networks, and I've got lots of contacts on there and I'm using those a lot. MySpace, I don't have that network there. Yeah, so it's not really doing on that grounds. For music, I'm just getting my head around discovery on Spotify.
Yeah.
And I'm getting the hang of the playlist side of it. And I've actually got a really good system coming in to actually find new music on there. So I haven't got that problem to solve either in a way that MySpace could. Yeah. So I'm not sure where it fits in for the moment.
Then we talked about MySpace some more when it went out of beta and the iOS app was launched on DMT 137 with Jeff Price, Jay Herskowitz and Marcus Taylor.
Sort of keep bashing MySpace, but I think we have to talk about MySpace as a.
I don't think we have a choice.
No, I don't think we have a choice, unfortunately. but I just want to talk about the last story for today, which is MySpace, removing the beta from its new product, and it's now open to everyone. And they also launched an iOS app that allows browsing, listening, exploring of pages. Although I couldn't really get the radio feature to work. I'm not sure if it's because I'm the UK or anything, and also it allows you randomly to shoot animated GIFs to post on the site, which is a nice nod, I guess, to MySpace's pioneering role in the deployment of GIFs all across the internet, which have recently had a bit of a resurgence on the web. So the company is apparently spending also $20 million on advertising, which I didn't even know they had that amount of money to spend on something like an advertising campaign aimed at driving users to the site and to the app. And it's very bullish about its radio future as well. It says that it its personalized playlists are much better than the iTunes radio offering, even because Apple has chosen an algorithmic approach and they are going for a personal approach on playlisting. So I mean, I remain skeptical about it, and I don't know whether people are gonna go and stay on the new site, but I just want to hear your opinions on both the developments of the beta as it progressed since launch, and also if you have tried out the iOS app, I would love to hear what you think about it. Marcus?
Yeah, I mean, I'm similarly quite skeptical about whether it's going to be that big or not, but I mean, it kind of strikes me that MySpace are almost going through this identity crisis, because From what I've sort of read, it doesn't seem like they really have a clear idea on what it is they're doing. It's kind of social radio plus this Vine GIF tool. plus they're talking about kind of having it as a platform for artists as well. So it almost seems that they're being pulled in a few different directions. That said, I was extremely impressed with the user experience, which is something that I think MySpace really struggled with in the past. I tried it out expecting to have all these pop-ups and to be listening to one genre and then be redirected to something completely different. But it's actually the UI that they've gone for is pretty nice, and so it does seem like they're making progress, but I'm still skeptical.
Yeah. Jay, your thoughts on the new MySpace? Have you tried out the new app?
I have not tried out the iOS app. I looked at the site redesign, and I thought it's pretty but kind of unusable, and I don't know why I would go there. And I don't say that to sound, like a dick, but it was,
absolutely.
Aesthetically, it was very pretty. A horizontal scroll on a website just, I just don't think works. It's hard to scroll horizontally. There's some music there and you can play it. It's cool. But the question was, what was the kind of compelling reason that people would come there from where they already are?
Yeah.
And I don't know if I found that.
Absolutely.
So, it's a product that's, somewhat nicely done, but, unclear as to why I'd use it over what I'm already using.
Yeah. And Jeff, for you, does it warrant that kind of advertising spend? And also from an independence perspective, I know they've had a lot of issues with Merlin, for example, at launch, and I'm not sure if those are still ongoing or not. But, they didn't have a good vibe at launch because of those issues. Well, what are your thoughts on the new MySpace?
Well, I haven't visited MySpace in 3 years. I haven't had a reason to. I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything.
Yeah.
And it's not even in the forefront of my mind. So you guys have me at a disadvantage. But to me, that speaks volumes. Like, I'm supposed to know this stuff. If I feel absolutely no reason to go there, why is anyone else?
Yeah. I think we're just trying it out just for kicks. But.
I don't mean to put you guys down.
I mean, the interesting point about the 20 million, in light of our earlier conversation, they could have given away
20 million.
They could have given away 4 million Jay-Z albums, right?
Yeah.
They could have paid me to use the service. Yeah, I'll send you a check for $10.
But so it'll be interesting to see. I thought they were going to do more with Justin Timberlake with the release of his album, and it was kind of like,
But it's just like, but what could they possibly do at this point that hasn't been done? They're not going to have music that other places don't have. They don't have the user base. They don't have integration into hardware. They don't have proprietary operating systems. They have a brand name which is tarnished to all hell. I don't get it, but, I've been wrong before.
Yeah, even Justin Timberlake himself, as much as he pushed it at South by Southwest, he still, operated on a completely traditional model for the marketing of his album, and that wasn't reliant in any way, shape, or form on MySpace. I think the only thing that he pushed on was when he did the free gig at South by Southwest, you had to sign into the new MySpace in order to be allowed in. Mm-hmm. So I think that was the only really major driver that I've seen him push on for the campaign of the album.
Apple have 500 million people registered with them with credit cards on file, and how many hundreds of millions of hardware devices? The integration to and Google. I don't get it. I just watch these struggling entrepreneurs trying to raise money for their organizations with some great ideas. Look at you and Tomahawk, and then you look at the money being poured into MySpace, and it's just like, oh dear God,
what they're doing. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, you could certainly make an argument, and I think, lots of people do, that that product and site would be getting a lot more positive press and response if it wasn't called MySpace.
Yeah.
Right? We could revive Friendster next.
Right. It's such an albatross around their neck. It was the same thing when I was at New Music Seminar. There was a guy up there from Boink, Beyond Oblivion. And I'm just thinking, why would you keep that name. You know, there's nothing good that comes out of being associated with that brand. So
yeah.
I was just more shocked that somebody, like, the people like, well, a brand exists before, therefore let's capitalize on it. When I think most of the time, if the brand's already been tarnished, you're doing much more harm than good.
And the Twitter Music was one of the big launches in the first half of 2013. So we start with a DMT 125 with Dave Allen and Nicke Osterbach on the first rumors. And it was something that came out of CNET, and they revealed that Twitter acquired the music recommendation and discovery service We Are Hunted in late 2012, and is working on creating its own music app that is slated for release quite soon. So CNET, in the original article, speculated that it could be as early as the end of March that this app comes out, which is supposedly called Twitter Music. But now, 2 weeks later, you know, it's the 27th, there's only a few days left of March, so for that prediction to come true, really. And whilst there's going to be a standalone app, the whole element of the Twitter Music thing is going to be around hashtags, so different hashtags to highlight different types of discovery of music, as to whether it's something you're listening to now, something that is popping up as becoming popular, or something that is already popular. And the other big thing about this is that Twitter would include SoundCloud as their primary partner for this Twitter Music service. So some really interesting stuff coming out of there, and Twitter was one of the few companies that we hadn't really heard much from in terms of music and music planning. So the first thing that I wanted to ask you is, you know, what do you think about Twitter and music recommendations in a vertical with a company like We Are Hunted? Like, what do you think they can achieve on that front? Nicke, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think Twitter bought We Are Hunted for the way that they process data, I believe. So I think it's basically, it's for them to buy a piece of technology which they feel like they can actually use and plug into their service to then, you know, actually show what's popular in their minds.
Yeah.
Whether, like, how good, like, We Are Hunted's technology is, like, that's also up for debate. It's kind of, you know, in the same league with, like, Hype Machines and such, but, like, they have their own algorithm.
Yeah.
But I think, like, crucially with this piece of news, like, the Twitter Music is, what's powering the music, which is SoundCloud.
Yeah.
And that's the key thing, is like, if you're not on SoundCloud, you're not on Twitter Music. And what does that mean for the service? And crucially, I think it's like, how's that, like, it's a bit of a hot topic now with licensing music and how SoundCloud is paying the copyright holder. So I think, like, it's really good as long as their music powering tool SoundCloud works and no one kind of cuts off that power cord.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Twitter is my favorite sort of network, given all the popular social platforms. Twitter I use the most, and I've always seen it as a major business tool and a major news tool. So, you know, to add on this sort of music discovery piece is kind of interesting. I like the connection with SoundCloud. SoundCloud is, I think, one of the best ways for artists, particularly who own their own copyrights, and even some who don't, who can just pop things up there for people to discover. I'm really getting a little concerned about how many players are in this space, though.
Yeah.
You know, I've always believed very strongly, perhaps being a little older than you two, and having had a long career in music, I was always very fond of the DJ being the filter for music. You know, so of course the top of the pile there was John Peel, who really got me started in punk rock way back in 1977. You know, just by being that filter, and it was very, very exciting. Now, what I'm finding now is this flat landscape. Where there are no filters, there are no peaks and troughs, there are only, wow, you know, 20,000 people like this or tweeted this hashtag today. And going back to SoundCloud, though, I think that, and also Mixcloud out of the UK, I really, really like that too. They're my two music services that I like to use the most. And just to finish up here, my thought is, you know, I've often written about on my blog about the sort of intellectual failure of streaming. It's like if we're only accessing all the same catalogs forever and ever, the companies that the Spotify's, the Mogs, the RDOs of the world, if they're only able to get the same catalog and the filtering within those platforms is, as I say, fairly flat or crowdsourced, I'm not so sure that's really the future of music here. That's just more the a reality that people don't want to own music. They really just want to rent it or get it for free.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting how this pans out with Twitter.
Then on DMT 129, on the week of release of the Twitter Music app, I talked with Elliot Van Buskirk and Ben Cesario about their first impressions. First of all, I want to hear your thoughts. You know, there's been a bunch of reviews around on people that were disappointed, people that like it, kind of contrasting opinions. So Elliot, what's your take on Twitter Music?
Well, I like it because I liked, I think I was the first person to write about We Are Hunted when I was at Wired. I think this was 2009. I called it this fantastic new way to discover music, and the article actually did really well. I think it was just the image of seeing all of that music tiled with play buttons.
Yeah.
My feeling is that even people who know how to do complicated things with computers don't like to. And so anything that makes it that simple to, the way that We Are Hunted sort of looked at the whole internet, including Twitter, and just spat it out in this easy to digest thing where you're like, you know, a monkey could figure out how to click on those images.
Yeah.
And I think that that design element is great. And now they're focusing all of their data scraping on Twitter. And it seems like a pretty natural fit. I really like the design too.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I had the same experience. We Are Hunted was the first company I ever interviewed on this show back in April 2009. So it was show number 2, I think. Nick Crocker on. It was a week after they launched. So that's been a while. I've known the company for a while as well. And
so where's our Twitter stock? Is my question. You know.
Yeah. Ben, what's your take?
Well, I agree that We Are Hunted, you know, was a very attractive interface, and it was a good idea. I just wonder what it's going to do on Twitter, and really what people on Twitter will use that for, if anything. I mean, there definitely was, you know, a few days of poking around and experimentation, and we were all finding our favorite band and saying now playing. But I was just scanning through the last couple of days, and a lot of this has really trailed off. Mm-hmm. In fact, Ryan Seacrest, who they gave early access to, I checked, and his last post having anything to do with this was several days ago, where he said, "Hey guys, what do you think about the new Twitter Music app?" So I think the idea that people, first of all, will be using the app on their phones means that they're going to leave Twitter and go to another separate app that really has nothing to do with Twitter, or that they'll be on their computer and going back and forth to that Discover tab. I just think that just doesn't sound like the cool, simple, you know, Twitter that I know. And I also think we're just flooded with kind of music discovery and with tools that scrape the internet and recommend things to us. So I think this has a real hurdle about proving that its discovery will be better. You know, its push and discovery will be better than everybody else's discovery. I do think it's good that one thing that I think is really important about it is that it makes it easier just to put music on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, the embedding in tweets is good. And it was interesting that SoundCloud was not part of this.
Exactly.
I think they probably will be, is my guess, my understanding. But when, you know, I don't know, sooner or later, it'll happen. But I guess bottom line, the discovery doesn't really mean much to me, but the functionality of the embedding, I think, is promising.
And on DMT 130, Flying Solo, I covered the rapid fall of the Twitter Music app in the iTunes Store charts. Moving on, Twitter Music had a fairly bad week as the app Twitter hashtag music
failed to gain momentum on the iTunes store. So the app, when it came out, debuted at number 1 in the music category and at number 5 in the overall free apps chart in the US, of course. But it quickly fell to respectively number 11 and number 124 for the overall chart, or at least these were the figures a couple of hours ago when I checked. In the UK, it's doing even worse, with the app not even appearing in the top 200 chart now, at least when I checked, and it's only 34th in the free music apps section. So critics of the app pointed to the fact that you have to be a subscriber of either Audio or Spotify to get a decent experience. And if you're not, then you're stuck with the samples that iTunes gives you, which are, I think, 60 or 90 seconds. So not a great experience for the majority of users that would have downloaded the app. And also, it's a closed ecosystem. You have to go into the app to see what's happening over there. And a lot of people pointed to the fact that it wasn't delivering fantastic recommendations to them. But as a premium subscriber of Spotify, I found myself going back to it, at least once every couple of days to check what's happening on it. And I think it could have a chance of bouncing back if they could enlist the free streaming platforms like Vivo and SoundCloud, for example. I think that would really help in drawing in people that are not currently premium subscribers of streaming music services, which at the moment is still the majority of people. Like, let's face it, they are gaining momentum, but the streaming services are not yet totally mainstream. Google's streaming service, now known as Google Play Music All Access, was still just a rumor in episode 122, where we talked about it with Darren Hemmings and Matthew Hahn. This week, we're going to start by talking about Google. I think it's only fair, as they announced, they didn't announce anything, but the Financial Times reported on Friday that Google is in talks with labels and publishers to start a new streaming service that would compete with the likes of Spotify, Deezer, and Rhapsody, and the upcoming Daisy as well, of course. So the FT maintained that the launch date is imminent, but The Verge actually published another report a day later, saying that they, according to their sources, the service wouldn't really be able to go live until Q3 of this year. So first of all, this is a huge news for the industry if Google does go ahead with this. Of course, Google has a huge involvement in music, as YouTube is the biggest music consumption space in the world for most people, especially a younger generation. And it has made some efforts with Google Play, but they haven't really gone very far in terms of music sales. So what is your first reaction, Matt, on hearing this news and hearing that Google wants to get into the space?
You mean wants to try again? Basically, they've had a couple of shots at this. I mean, when I was at Sony, we definitely had conversations on a number of levels, and this is yet round, 575, I think.
Yeah.
But it's good to hear that they're back, right? And I, for my friends who are working in the conversations with them now, and it's definitely, they're in conversations. Google is over a negotiator in Europe, and so we're actually seeing some motion. And once again, you're going to expect them to come into this and for the labels to hit right back with the piracy question, right? And the question of search and search results. So not surprised. I think The Verge is right. It's not going to happen until later this year.
Yeah.
Just there's lots of stuff to work out. But I think it's important that they try to make this step. I don't think Play is enough from the music space. They've got to have more than that with their device strategy and with Android. You've got to have more. So not surprised to hear them stepping back in. And I think it's welcome. More players there are, the better.
Yeah, of course. And Darren, of course, Google is kind of like a sprawling giant in the sense that it has so many divisions, and YouTube is still kind of a separate company, but it is part of Google. How do you feel this service could interlace with the stuff like G+ and YouTube and all that?
I mean, I think personally where YouTube goes, I wouldn't be at all surprised if Google themselves don't quite know how that can weave in, because it's such a kind of uncontrolled environment with the user uploads and the fact that they can't kind of order that data in a particularly kind of usable way. The fact that it's such a kind of sprawling mess compared to something like, Vivo, where you've got, it's very controlled, very ordered data getting uploaded and all that kind of thing, means I would imagine that they would probably treat it as kind of being, over there while the streaming service may remain over here for the time being. I mean, I would think the strategy, or the wiser strategy, would be to leave the two separate for the time being and just negotiate around, the music platform itself, which, I think it's it's good news, really. I mean, I'm sure it's sort of always tempered with that slight concern that these people will start throwing their weight around much further down the line in a kind of iTunes manner to dictate terms. So obviously there's a slight caveat around that. But in terms of competition in the marketplace and, you know, and the things that they could do, I think it's really interesting. But I think, yeah, for the time being, YouTube will sort of, I suspect, I wouldn't be at all surprised if their stock response is something to the effect of YouTube is our video platform, yeah, and, you know, the forthcoming music service is an audio platform, and for now, never the twain shall meet. But give it
conversation,
time.
All my conversations with people play exactly what Darren's saying on this, right? I mean, the YouTube team, YouTube music team, very strong, got a lot of great stuff going on, but the connection hasn't yet been made, I don't think, with these guys. And I think that to negotiate that when it's still in flux makes sense to me, that they would be saying, this is the music service and this is YouTube video. Yes, there's potentially some synergies there, but if they're coming out of the box with something that is already integrated, I'm going to be incredibly surprised given how fraught those negotiations already are.
Yeah.
Me as well, because everyone's worried about the piracy thing. But, you know, we're talking about a time when there's an antitrust lawsuit about Google kind of allegedly overplacing its own products, you know, ahead of others in their search results. So the minute they've got their own audio platform, one would assume that there's a high likelihood that the piracy things may very quietly start to vanish all the more, because they will then have an extremely vested interest in pushing their own platform. And, you know, I suspect there'll be a hilarious point years down the line where they're being sued for over-promoting their own legal audio platform over other platforms, and the piracy things dropped out of the picture. But yeah, we'll see. But I think it's not a point I've seen made yet, which I was quite surprised at.
Yeah.
So it'd be good to see. But in the main, I think it's a good thing, right? I mean, it's nice, isn't it? At the moment, to now have many players in the marketplace, that's what everyone wants, because we're, you know, emerging from a period where there's only been a couple and it's been a rather poor situation to be in. So I'm all for it.
The rumor gained more substance in DMT 132 prior to the announcement, as most of the facts had already leaked, and we discussed this with Stephen O'Reilly and Darren Hemmings. In the past few hours, The Verge broke the news in the early hours of this morning here in the UK, and then it was subsequently confirmed by the New York Times that Google is about to launch a music subscription service that is tied in with Google Play, and that will launch later on today during the mammoth 3-hour keynote that Google is going to give as the opening session of Google I/O. This is a fairly new development, because of course we knew that this was in the works, but we didn't know the time frame was quite so fast. And of course Google is pretty well known for launching stuff that is not quite fully baked at the I/O and then seeing it developed through the coming weeks and months after that. Apparently Warner Music was already signed, but it took a while for Universal Music and Sony to get on board. But they are on board, apparently, and so that gives Google a decent catalog to play with. And the most important and interesting part about the story is that it's apparently confirmed, I mean, this is all still speculation, I guess, but it's apparently confirmed that it's going to be a split between the Google Play part of the streaming subscription service, which is what is going to launch today, and then perhaps YouTube in a few months will launch with its own subscription service for YouTube, which entails different and separate negotiations with the rights holders. And so, of course, you know, we're a few hours away from the announcement, so all we can talk about today is speculations on the different options that Google has. But I think it will be actually interesting for the audience to hear sort of our take on it before the actual official product is announced. So first of all, Darren, what do you reckon? You know, is a split between YouTube and Google Play wise when it comes to music subscriptions, and why would Google want to do that?
It's certainly curious, isn't it? I mean, I think, I was reading a piece by Peter Kafka, I think, earlier, where, you know, he was saying it seems like they're doubling down on this in a rather bizarre manner, because rather than bet on a Google Play-led service, they're kind of doing both, which I suppose there's two ways of seeing it. You know, one is, I guess, Peter's view, which is that they're, you know, flipping and flopping a bit in terms of what they want to focus on, and they're trying to cover both sides. But equally, there's probably a flip side to that, which is that it's quite a clever move by providing an access point for both. And equally, you know, revenue streams for both. I mean, if we consider that the Google Play streaming music thing will just be kind of another streaming music service, then, you know, that has one particular market appeal. And I would imagine it's, you know, people like me who currently use RDO and Spotify and things like that. And, you know, I use the Google Play service to sync my iTunes content up to it. And I actually think it's a really good interface and it works very, very well. So if they extend that just to be presumably something that's along similar design lines and is simply a streaming service, then you know I'd be pretty happy with that. That will work quite well for me.
Yeah.
But I think what that forgets is that there's a massive market of kids particularly who use YouTube. And the way in which they consume and interact with music is on a very different level. And I think within that, you know, monetizing all content on YouTube and maybe ordering it a bit more so that you get whole albums on there and a better way to playlist them and organize them and things like that would work very, very well, you know. And so whilst I think one could be critical and say that they're hedging their bets and they're you know, not making a proper decision, I think the flip side of it from where I sit is that they're understanding that different people and different demographics consume in different ways. And that actually, when you look at it that way, it could be really quite a smart move. And equally, you know, it's a move where at a time when, you know, Android is certainly rising, I think, in terms of credibility. You know, I switched to an Android handset last year and I love it. That seems to be a kind of increasing, you know, story that you're seeing more and more. So within all of that, the timing seems quite right to add a kind of bolt-on music element to the Android OS, and equally for YouTube to kind of get slightly more whipped into shape to have ordered content rather than just being a mess of all this stuff anyway. Because let's not forget that at the moment, you know, the reality is that most stuff is all over YouTube anyway.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, the way in which they're trying to order this and monetize it and everything else makes good sense. So certainly if I was... you know, among the, you know, the industry label side, the rights holder side, I'd be pretty pleased with how this is shaping up because it's more players in the market.
It's a double payout.
Yeah, it's more revenue for you and kind of why not, right? Yeah. I mean, they're only, it's only because they own two platforms that they've got the rights to do this. You know, YouTube, once upon a time, was a totally different company. And therefore, if they were launching a music service, I don't think we'd be seeing it in quite the same way. But yeah, I think it can only be a good thing for the industry as a whole at the moment.
Yeah, and Stephen, it's interesting as well because, of course, Google Play will always have a much smaller footprint than YouTube in terms of its reach and its subscriber base, and that's true, of course, right now as well. If you look at the download store versus what YouTube, the juggernaut that the YouTube is, do you think that it could also be a way to for Google to soft launch, I guess, a subscription service and really understand what the kinks of having that out are before it rolls something out on a much larger scale on you know the billion or almost billion users a month that are on YouTube?
Absolutely. I think it's going to be really interesting to see the ways in which that they can embed you know these services on not just mobile but on other platforms, which is like super important to Google as well. You know, so like all the you know the new set-top boxes, the new connected televisions. You know, the fact that you've already got it on your phone and then you can easily kind of you know interact with that on different platforms is going to be to their benefit, I think.
Yeah. And Google, you know, because, and with Glass as well coming in into play.
Yeah, and all of the, you know, the, yeah, like, and if they can open it up to developers as well to build, like, if you look at some of the interesting things that have been built on the Spotify platform and on Deezer, I think, you know, people can do really cool things in the future with the things that Google are working on.
Yeah, and you make a really good point actually there because you're talking about developers' involvement, and of course Google I/O is a developers' conference. So the fact that they are planning to launch, if that actually happens, I mean it could all actually be completely untrue. But you know, assuming that the sources of the guys that have written about this, which are usually pretty good, are good, then you know the fact that they're launching at a developers' conference is pretty indicative of the fact that they are hoping to get developers involved in making stuff with the new service rather than just launching a service and making it live of its own accord. So that could be pretty cool, really, right?
Yeah, and I'm really excited to see how developers can kind of can get involved and to build a business on the back of that, because it's kind of really important to Google as a platform to have ways in which developers can monetize on top of Google Play and anything that you can sell through Google, because up until now, especially from my experience, you know, for Mobile Rodeo over the past 3 years, is that the majority of transactions happen on the iOS and Apple platform, It's very easy to purchase and transact and buy inside of your iPhone or your iPod or Apple TV. And Google need to make that attractive to developers to continue to be appealing and to make money for developers. Yeah. And any ways in which they can do so will lead to more developers moving away from Android or iOS, or being less focused on iOS and working more on Android because of the revenues.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it would be interesting actually to see what the kind of uptake of the man in the street will be. I mean, you know, as others have pointed out, there's some insane number of Android handsets out there. So in theory, there's quite a market to funnel down to paying customers, but whether they will is a different matter, because obviously the Google Play Store sells downloads at the moment, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't really feature in, you know, in any labels revenue streams in the top 10, I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah.
But I do, you know, I think sometimes Google can be quite clever at doing things that may not necessarily be the sexiest product on the block, but which do tend to get quite a pickup. And in fact, you could probably apply that to a lot of Google products at the moment. I mean, you know, Gmail, I always think, is not a particularly good-looking interface. It's a bit kind of functional, but it's, you know, probably the number one or number two email platform now. And the reason is that it's pretty powerful. It does a great job. And, you know, currently, obviously, it's free. But, you know, in due course, you know, as they're adding more and more ways in which you can use cloud storage and things, you know, the costs around all of it are still really, really cheap. So, you know, coming in with a product that may not be the most sexy on the block, but just kind of bolts in perfectly to your existing handset and comes with that kind of safe Google branding and everything, may be more compelling. But this is the kind of watershed moment, I guess, where we see just how much Google's brand can swing people when it comes to music.
Yeah, and it also gives you it's going to give us a perception of how much people associate Android with Google, because, of course, Apple has been very good at striking relationships directly with carriers when it comes to making handsets available across different markets, whilst when it comes to Android, it's more like the device's own manufacturer that has a relationship with the carrier rather than Google, because, of course, Android is customized for each and every single device. And so that's going to be interesting because, of course, Google doesn't have the same direct access to carriers as Apple, and so probably has a different way of pushing the service, if any at all. And it might have to go through the manufacturers of the handsets to push it, even though some of the manufacturers actually have competing services, like Samsung, for example. They have a competing service that would clash with Google's offering. So very interesting on that.
Well, I think, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Another area, sorry, Stu, was that I think is really interesting, and I mean, we're kind of watching with a wry smile, is the way in which Google is sort of slowly dominating the iPhone with numerous services, and the way in which they're now connecting these up in a web-like way, you know, so that you can now, you know, have a Gmail client that will launch links straight into the Chrome browser on iOS and everything else. And, you know, they've done an excellent, you know, by having such a kind of umbrella service there and a way in which it's funded and everything, they can easily kind of circumvent the whole subscription percentage issue that blights a lot of services when they're trying to get new subscribers on the iOS platform. So it's kind of interesting, you know, there's been some funny articles recently that are certainly very devil's advocate, but they put a case for, you know, Google slowly making the iPhone an Android phone as well by getting their products and shoehorning them between the Apple hardware and the Apple software. And one could argue whether they will try and do the same with music, where, you know, exactly the same thing will come in by way of a separate client, but will then have, you know, links out so that you can share it with your friends using the Gmail client or look the artist up in the Chrome browser and never technically exit the Google ecosystem while still being on your iOS device.
Yeah. So one other thing that I wanted to kind of, you know, just mention as well is, you know, even in handsets that are already available, you know, Android handsets, like if you've got, you know, the latest version of that OS or the previous version, It's very simple for Google just to surface their new app right to the front of your phone, you know, and that will like immediately bring, you know, potentially tens of millions of people that have already got those Android handsets, you know, like right in front of the viewer, you know, in front of the handset owner. It's just an incredible way to reach existing people. Never mind all of the bundling of stuff with new devices, but instantly they can, you know, like hundreds of millions of people can see that application or their new service, which is powerful.
That's great. Yeah, I didn't know that because I haven't used one consistently yet. So
yeah.
I'm gonna have to make the jump at some point.
Well, Darren is an Android user, and I'm sure he'll see the apps that are being promoted at the moment on Play, and like if you can get your app to the front of that feature, it's a guaranteed hundreds of thousands of downloads a day. You know, almost guaranteed.
Yeah, that's great. And on DMT 133, we looked at the finer details from the Google Play Music All Access announcement with Duncan Gier and Virginie Berger. Cool. Well, and of course, we have to touch upon the Google Play Music All Access story. So Google launched the subscription service last Wednesday night, and the service will be a similar, you know, priced exactly the same as Spotify in the US at $9.99 per month, aside from an introductory pricing of $7.99 for those who sign up before June 30th. And so it's kind of a couple of bucks saving per month if you sign up and switch right now. Google also used the line Radio Without Rules, so which kind of takes a bit of a shot at both Pandora and Spotify, in the sense that, you know, they really wanted to stress the simplicity with which you can access, for example, radio stations on the service, and the Listen Now feature, where you can they line up for you a bunch of tracks that they think you're gonna like, and so, you know, there's been a lot of articles talking about the pros and the cons of the new service. And for me, I don't see it making a big splash, to be honest. Until Google rolls out a YouTube service, it's gonna be a relatively small service, even if the base of Android users is huge. But I don't know. Like, do you have any thoughts, Duncan, after hearing the announcement and on what people might make of this?
Well, I mean, the one thing we didn't know this time last week is what it was going to be called. And Google Play All Access Music is probably the worst title for a streaming music service that I've heard since Nokia's Comes With Music. It's awful. It just sounds like you can't imagine them sitting there saying, well, let's call it, it's got to have music in because it's a music service, and All Access. Yeah, we want to call it All Access, but it's got to have Google Play in there too. It's ridiculous.
It sounds like a Microsoft decision, doesn't it?
It really does. And that gives me actually quite a lot to worry about, because Google never used to be like this. And they seem to be changing in a much, much more Microsofty direction, which I don't like. In terms of the actual service itself, it isn't very exciting. It doesn't do anything that Spotify doesn't really do already. Spotify does other stuff better. It has more features and functionality. It's easier to use. I can't see, in its current state, it gaining an awful lot of traction.
Yeah. Virginie, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I fully agree with Duncan.
Yeah, really. Absolutely.
And especially about the Microsoft Googleization. But, you know, in France, I'm not sure if we can have Google Music in France because of the same and everything as usual. So I don't even know if I can try Google Music.
Yeah.
But as you know, we have Deezer in France, so it can be difficult for Google.
Yeah. And Spotify featured on DMT 131 as it acquired the startup Tunigo. So we discussed this with Adam Webb and Richard Kirstein. Spotify announced the acquisition of this music startup Tunigo just a couple of days ago. So Tunigo is a Swedish service that established itself as one of the most popular applications on the Spotify client, and then also launched an iOS application. So what Tunigo does is help users find playlists that fit with their current activity, mood, or state of mind, and lets you select the preferred genre in the process, and also then presents you with a bunch of playlists that you can choose from. So in a way, it's not too dissimilar to Songza, which is a service that we're going to talk about in the second story. And it also marks the return of Spotify as on the acquisitions table after quite a long time spent just on internal development. So, and that's actually quite interesting, because to all of us who have been wondering what the business model of the apps that have launched purely on a Spotify client and developed their audience on there, what their business model would be, given that at the moment you can't really monetize the Spotify clients. Well, there is a business model for you being acquired by Spotify themselves, and that seems to have worked for Tunigo. So, you know, the app seems to work really well. Actually, I hadn't used the iOS version of it, and I've used it in the last couple of days, and it's pretty great. I really like it, and it seems to make complete sense for Spotify to move into the space. I just wonder what kind of integration they're gonna do in the future from the service, and whether they're gonna think of offering something along those lines anytime soon. So guys, first of all, Adam, what are your thoughts on this acquisition, and do you think that Spotify will look at integrating more deeply the Chinugo services into their own brand?
I think in a sense it's interesting. In a sense, though, I feel slightly bombarded with announcements almost on a daily basis about recommendation and almost this sense that discovery is this massive problem that needs to be fixed. And I'm personally not actually so sure it is a massive problem that needs to be fixed. And a lot of the apps, and I'll use things like Pitchfork and This Is My Jam, and I will use certain things, but a lot of them, I it's a bit like with the Twitter music service. I don't think it's for me particularly, and I'm not sure a lot of the recommendations it serves up, a lot of those people are probably just going to be interested in radio and sort of typical one or quite normal curations, I guess, really.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, but I must have seen, I don't know how many sort of social recommendation discovery apps have been launched this year, but it's got to be in the sort of 20s or 30s, I would have thought.
Yeah, that's right. And Richard, of course, Spotify had done a big announcement on their sort of discovery side back in December, I think, and nothing's come out yet on really prominent on their front. I mean, they got the new artist pages, of course, but nothing purely on discovery that is really making the moves. So do you think that was also a move to try and acquire a company that's doing really well in the field without having to spend a great deal of time internally to working on that?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. But I mean, I would go along with Adam in that I think that the whole issue around discovery is possibly overplayed, in that there may be a lot of companies that see it as being a far bigger problem than it really is. I mean, that may well be a generational thing.
Yeah.
From my own perspective, it'd be interesting to see to what extent Spotify can leverage this with brands, which is the area that I work in. It remains to be seen whether or not brands would see this as a useful thing. I think there's an overall problem of possibly too many startups with, as Adam says, daily launches of services which may actually not be needed.
And Nigel Godric's remarks on streaming spurred a big debate on Spotify, which lasted for a couple of weeks afterwards. And we talked about this on DMT 141 with our most numerous panel yet, featuring Duncan Gier, Eric Eitel and Andrea Grutzke, Martin Davies and Darren Hemmings. So first of all, I want to go around everybody and just talk about what was your first reaction when you heard about this. Did you expect somebody to at some point come out on this particular debate with such force and somebody so influential? And at the same time, why do you think somebody like Nigel Godric and Tom York makes sense to have kick-started once again a debate that has really been ongoing in the industry press for a long time? So first of all, Duncan, any thoughts on the matter?
Well, I mean, to answer the question of what my first thought was, I was really disappointed because I'm actually quite a big Nigel Godrich fan. I love a lot of the production work he's done, not just on Radiohead, but also on people like Beck and Travis and The Divine Comedy, all kinds of people. He's done some amazing, amazing musical work. And that's why I was so disappointed that somebody who I respected so much on a musical point of view could be so, as I see it, kind of short-sighted in not really seeing the benefits of a streaming service.
Yeah, and Darren, on your side, what do you think? What do you think is your main reaction from that when you saw that?
A degree of eye rolling on a similar level, I think, to Duncan, in the sense that my unease around this often stems from the fact that it won't endear me to the artist community, but I often feel that artists tend not to be the best people to speak out on this stuff because.
Yeah.
There's a reason that you have labels and managers and marketing people and things like that, and it's usually so that, theoretically at least, the artists can be left to get on with their art and being creative. Now, that's not to dumb them down or insult them by saying that they're too stupid to be a part of the discussion, but certainly, based on what I know and based on what I see people then saying online where you've had artists speak out, often, particularly when they start quoting numbers and things like that, they're
frequently a little bit wide of the mark and things like that. So my initial response was certainly a bit of a, oh God, here we go again sort of thing. Beyond that, I think it's probably opened up like a good discussion there relative to what more Spotify could do. I don't think that's a bad discussion to have, but I think you can have that discussion without demonizing Spotify in the process. And,
yeah, of course.
And equally, as an aside, I do slightly tire of everyone pointing the finger at Spotify. I mean, God, that's something like a massive critic.
It's essentially like a scapegoat for every single, you know, it's a good name to face to put to a name of streaming services, because the public would probably take less interest in it if it just says streaming services are bad. But if it says Spotify are bad, they have somebody to pin it onto. And Martino, what was your reaction when you saw these tweets, first of all?
I think for me, probably again, a similar level of eye rolling and also a kind of sense of, oh, not again. You know, this kind of, it crops up, you know, almost every month at the minute. Someone has to speak out and say, oh yeah, by the way, streaming services, they're not paying us enough, just in case you'd forgotten about last month where they weren't paying us enough still. And I don't know, some of the tweets just felt kind of stream of consciousness, which is fair enough, and a little bit misinformed. I mean, the comparison of, you know, it's not like radio is possibly one of the stupidest things he possibly could have said. Everybody gets it's not like radio. The reason that the royalty payments aren't the same is simply because you're not forced to listen to the music on a streaming service. It's your choice. If you're listening to the radio, you are forced to listen to what they play you. So say, for instance, like Radio 1 share of that market is 8 to 10 million people. They have to pay a higher royalty payment because that's the amount of people that are going to be listening to a track at a particular time. You cannot do a comparison of streaming service and radio and complain that one pays more and the other doesn't. It's ridiculous.
And Eric and Andrea, respectively, like, what are your thoughts on the reactions front?
Yeah, I just saw this article on Fact Magazine today that Tom York's, one of the Radiohead's co-managers, Brian Message, actually made his own point on public intervention and said, like, it's actually an ongoing debate. So as you guys said already, I mean, this is a discussion that is going on for quite a while, and it's just some more input and maybe a sign set, but I also see it as an ongoing debate. And I think this comment by Brian was actually pretty cool to make at this point, to just calm it down a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, I think it's important to just have like a very relaxed debate about this, because we've all said that this is something that's been going on for quite some time. And of course, this is not the first artist that points the problem out. I think what makes the story interesting this week is the fact that I think it comes at a time where perhaps there are different factors coming in, converging to make people think about these issues a little bit more than maybe they have in the past few months, or where, especially in the US, the debate has all been centered around Pandora and internet radio rates. And so I guess this brings a little bit of focus back onto Spotify and what they are doing and what they're not doing. And so one of the the first things that I wanted to talk about was that a few of the articles that came out were talking about what artists should expect from streaming services, and whether they should expect to be making more money off them. So whether the services are not paying them enough. You know, of course, we know that Spotify is paying around 70% of their income into royalties. So that's already quite a high percentage. And it's similar in a way to what iTunes pays back on download sales. So, you know, an interesting point from Zach Greenberg from Forbes was, for example, that if you're a musician and you're just starting out, you don't get really almost any spins on the radio, you don't get millions of downloads on the iTunes store, you probably don't have a record deal, and so should you be expecting to make a significant amount of money from a smaller number of plays? And Martin pointed me to a Guardian piece that was published yesterday on the artist Sam Duckworth, that points out he's an independent artist. He points to his 4,685 Spotify plays from his last solo album that equated to £19. And so this is an example of an artist that is, you know, starting out, is not making a lot of money from Spotify, but is not making a lot of money in general, probably anyway. So should artists be expecting to make more money from the service? And if so, is that even feasible? Because Spotify is already paying so much in royalties. Martin, any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think it's always, you know, it's fair to expect that, you know, at a certain point you should probably be getting more, particularly, you know, when you look at the amount of investment that companies like Spotify take on, you think, oh, okay, well, they have, you know, $300 million. Why can't I have a little bit more for my money? I think there's a real lack of understanding against more traditional models like putting out physical records or getting your stuff played on the radio versus streaming, that people don't necessarily understand how those companies, which are innately a software company, actually work and can operate and how much that actually costs, particularly when it comes to the infrastructure required to manage the kind of loads that these services are under. And I think that there is the kind of expectation that because it's just a way of delivering music, that it's the same as everything that has gone before and therefore should be paying its fair share. But that is not the case in any way. This is a new model still. This is a different way of doing things. And, you know, they're paying, in my mind, as much as they probably can pay at this moment in time. And that may well increase down the line. Yeah. If there's a significant change, maybe after an IPO, you know, which would be interesting in itself. But at the moment, I think, you know, what's being paid, you know, per stream equates to, you know, something fair enough. If you're going to get 5,000 streams and that's going to pay you £19, you know, equivalents elsewhere would be relatively similar.
Yeah. Yeah. And Darren, do you get that, you know, speaking to artists directly, do you feel like there is a sense that they would like to see more money coming from the service, or is there a generally an understanding that this is the deal and that's how it goes?
I mean, you know, I work on a lot of artist campaigns, and while I haven't debated this with them directly, I mean, you know, anecdotally, certainly artists I've talked to have, you know, expressed that kind of maxim of, oh, they don't pay enough and things like that, as if it's just a sort of truism, really.
Yeah.
Artists, everyone's always going to want more money, right? So, you know, everybody's going to sit there and, given the option, if someone said, would you like us to pay you more, then only a fool would say no. But equally, you know, I've seen observations across the board where people are kind of saying, well, you know, records aren't really where you make a huge amount of money anyway. And there's I have a slight issue with artists. You know, I read the Sam Duckworth piece about people consuming that, you know, his streams and the money he got from it. But there's a sort of weird thing there where it's being talked about as if this is his sole stream of income, you know, yeah. And it's, yeah. I find that a bit odd. And it's just, you know, you have to find new ways of doing things. And that's not to excuse this. I mean, I don't want to start on a default position of kind of Spotify pays a perfectly good amount and everyone should stop moaning. That's not it at all. But it bothers me slightly when these things are pulled a little bit out of context from the bigger picture of, you know, all of the broader income streams. I mean, that's why I was quite pleased when I saw that Eamon Ford posted quite a nice little summary on The Guardian of all the other places that artists can make money.
Yeah.
Because it's an important consideration in the conversation. You know, and those sorts of things I think are pretty important. And, you know, and it does lead on to this whole issue of, you know, could Spotify do more to kind of upsell on behalf of artists? And I think probably the answer to that is yes. And I suspect that's where Jimmy Iovine's service, you know, with Beats and that, may seek to sort of potentially gain some ground. But
yeah,
I mean, you know, an artist sort of saying, "Well, we'd like to earn more money from that," is a bit kind of like, "Well, duh," you know, really. That's the nature of the game. But and I think also there's a sort of strange kind of righteousness and indignation around this whole topic. When I think there's an ogre that you could always hold up over the years, whether it was MTV building empires, you know, billion-dollar empire without sufficiently paying people, or the US radio system, which until only a few years ago was paying absolutely nothing but play. You know, there's always been these things where people can stand up and complain about them, but the industry has sort of endured and adapted and survived, you know, throughout that. So I don't feel like this is perhaps as catastrophic as it's being made out to be.
Yeah, and Spotify's 2012 earnings were released during the recording of DMT 143. So I talked about that with Glenn Peoples from Billboard. Glenn, I've got some hot of the press numbers on Spotify. Actually, they just came out through the Financial Times. And the report is that from the financial statements filed in Luxembourg, I would assume it's today, the company went from 190 million euros of sales in 2011 to 434 million euros of sales in 2012, whilst losses went from 45.4 million euros in 2011 to 58.7 million euros in 2012. So, I mean, I'm just looking at the, you know, the headline numbers here. I'm sure there's going to be more insights to be had from looking at the in-depth accounts of what happened, but it does look like the sales more than doubled, whilst the losses only increased by $30 million, which is much less than doubling. So I guess in a way, okay, it's still losing a bunch of money for sure, but it's not losing it at the same pace as it is gaining income. So that's got to be a good sign, right?
Sure. Yeah, the loss as a percentage of revenue was lower this year than the previous one. Absolutely. I think the most important thing to keep in mind when looking at Spotify's earnings numbers is that you're actually looking at financial performance in a lot of different markets at once. And some markets like Sweden and Norway and Netherlands, they do very well, and they've been in those markets for a long time. And then you have the United States, which is a big market, but they've only been there 2 years. And they've been in Australia and New Zealand less than a little over 1 year now. But as in terms of those numbers that we've seen, it was about half the year because they entered Spotify entered New Zealand, Australia in May of last year.
Yeah.
So the business model will mature at different rates depending on the market. And also it means that there's kind of a lag time, I think. It makes sense that the business model based on getting subscribers based on free listening is going to have higher expenses in early years than in later years.
Yeah.
And what we've seen is the cost of sales decreases a percent of revenue from 2011 to 2012. So they are paying out less a percent of revenue, a lower percent of revenue to rights holders as the company grows and gets scale and matures in different markets. And I think that's, I think that's really important because it shows that the business model can work. It's not profitable yet, but it can work. Given enough scale and given enough time and newer markets to mature, it's going to be keeping more revenue, and it's going to be, it's not going to have, what was it last year, 97% of revenue they paid out to rights holders. Obviously, that's unsustainable. Well, I might have got that number wrong, but luckily I have it right here in front of me.
That seems high.
Yeah, it was 97 last year, and there was 83.5% this year. So the decrease in cost of sales as a percent of revenue is very important. That shows the model is maturing, and I think that's really the most important thing to look at here. Now, whether or not that's ultimately good for artists, that's a whole different story. I think some artists say, well, it's an unsustainable model, and we're not getting paid enough. I think it's a sustainable model over the long term. Whether or not artists are being paid enough is a whole separate conversation.
And iTunes Radio was still called iRadio when we discussed it in DMT 132, talking about how Apple was supposedly struggling to get the necessary deals together, chatting with Stephen O'Reilly and Darren Hemmings.
That's great.
Cool. Well, this story kind of ties into the next story, which is talking about Apple and the fact that the Financial Times reported this week that the company has hit a bit of a roadblock in the negotiations with Warner and Sony for their iRadio service after reportedly signing up Universal a little while ago. And Warner is supposed to be closer to the deal than Sony, which is still a little bit of in the high seas as the deal goes. But the core issue, of course, is one on revenue. And of course, labels have wanted to get as much from Apple as possible. Of course, when a big tech giant like that comes to labels, they see it as a great opportunity to increase their revenues. And supposedly, the Financial Times said that sources close to the matter reported that labels have already managed to increase the royalty rate offered by Apple from 6 cents per 100 tracks streamed to 12.5 per 100 tracks streamed, which is similar to what Pandora pays. But Apple also offers some add-ons to that, so that they offer, the opportunity to upsell through the iTunes store, and they are also, I think, offering a guarantee base for the labels in case the service doesn't take off as well as they think they might. And so this is an interesting tie-in because, of course, iRadio, a very different service from an on-demand service, and it kind of brings in different elements of discovery and also a potential upsell. And I think this conversation also ties into the Daft Punk pre-release stream that's happening right now and started yesterday, that brought tens of millions of or hundreds of millions of people to the iTunes store to check out the new album by Daft Punk. And so that really shows like the potential of having a streaming service within the iTunes environment that then ties into directly the download store. So of course the roadblocks are problematic for Apple, because you know that they probably would like to get a service up and running for the next version of iOS, so probably iOS 7. And at this point, do the labels have more to lose if MP3s start stalling because you know the service is not getting off the ground, or does Apple have more to lose if the service doesn't get off the ground? Stephen, what's your take on that?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I think people, like, the fact that it's taken so long is, you know, kind of because there's so much at stake, you know, from, you know, Apple and their downloads of, you know, tracks. And then, you know, the labels, you know, just the sheer revenues that pass through iTunes and the dependency on that stream of revenue. So I think it's been a real shame it's taken so long to launch. And in the meantime, other platforms, you know, like Audio and Spotify have been kind of making interesting inroads into those kind of, you know, trying to build out those services, you know, the kind of radio service inside their existing platforms. And again, like, to come back to some of the other apps that are launching within, you know, things like Shuffler FM as an iPhone application or an Android app. And I'm not so sure how, to me, something like iRadio is not so important to me as a user, but perhaps to my mom or my dad or my sister. They might be interested in more of the discovery kind of stuff. I just think it's a shame that it's taken so long, but I guess there's a lot of vested interest behind the delays.
Yeah, absolutely. Darren, what's your take? Is Apple offering too little, or are the labels being greedy, or what's the real problem here?
No, I mean, I think there's a few considerations and certainly some possibilities. I mean, the reality is that, you know, iTunes still drives a massive amount of revenue. And, you know, there's a question to which, you know, would iRadio or whatever it's going to be called kind of chip into that by actually distracting people from a conversion to sale? I mean, the beauty of a Daft Punk stream on iTunes is that you're right there with a big fat buy button next to it, and a very seamless integrated way to then ensure that that lands on your device the minute it's made available. So, you know, that whole system they have at present is pretty compelling. I'd say, I mean, I'm a bit with Steve on this one, in that I still find the whole discussion around iRadio as a product quite weird, but only because, I don't know if it's market dominant, well, I say market dominance, probably press dominance of sort of Spotify and Audio and proper on-demand streaming that makes me sort of look at a radio-type model as Pandora and, you know, and its ilk, and just sort of be slightly baffled, because I'm the same as Stephen. I wouldn't actually run to use it anyway. So, but and equally, I wonder if there's just a simple thing here where, you know, I think it's safe to say that, you know, Apple built a massive platform with iTunes and certainly will have exerted some, you know, pressure and thrown its weight around a little bit with all of that to start telling labels how they should be doing things and stuff like that. So I wonder if there's a kind of once bitten, twice shy degree to this as well, whereby labels would really rather not continue to build Apple's empire. And, you know, it certainly, even from where I sit, which is not as a sort of content owner, you know, I still look at what's going on and just kind of think, well, this is great, because we're now back to a real kind of market full of stuff going on there in all kinds of different areas. And it's a really interesting time and very competitive, and that's only to the music industry's benefit. You know, I think that's a good thing, because if you have that world where there's only really Apple on the block and they start to dictate terms to everyone, you know, that's not necessarily a very healthy sort of system to have running.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it would be interesting, you know. But for me, I must admit, I think because those kind of web radio models haven't taken off in the UK particularly, I think people like us tend to look at it and shrug a bit, because I think the UK is, you know, Rhapsody didn't take off over here. Pandora hasn't launched over here. It just feels like they're all avoiding this area. And you've got to wonder whether it's just because the market is, you know, people don't care that much.
Yeah.
have a very vibrant radio world in the UK. You know, we have Radio 1, the BBC, all of these things. That means that people in the UK are actually pretty fervent radio listeners to traditional radio. In the US, it's a totally different story, where radio is kind of just a whole, you know, it's way more dead in terms of its commercial viability. That's allowed then things like Pandora and that to come in. But over here, less so. So I think it's a funny one, you know, whether there's a true market need for it. But we'll see. But I think my gut feeling at the moment is probably more that labels are more interested in building a competitive environment, and that's not really helped by doing deals with Apple. And then I would imagine when Apple come in and have especially competitive terms that they're trying to win, the labels are all sat there thinking, well, no, you're right. You know, you sell our downloads. We've got Spotify. We've got audio. They're all growing well. Why would we sign this?
In DMT 136, instead, we discuss iTunes Radio in detail with Clyde Smith from HiPod, Jim Carroll from the Irish Times, and Alejandro Marin from the Music Pimp blog. This week, we can get started right away, and there's only one news story to rule them all, and that is the announcement of iTunes Radio. So this story started breaking about 10 days ago when it was reported by the Financial Times, I believe, that Warner Music and Warner Chappell had reached a deal with Apple, and that the company was poised to announce a WWDC. So I was actually pretty skeptical at the time, because it seemed an awfully fast timeline, but closer to the date, we heard of more deals being made, until finally Sony ATV closed up the loop of major labels and publishers. So, you know, and announced it was, of course, but it was left to the last 10 minutes or so of the keynote, and Apple didn't seem like they made a massive deal out of it. It was part of their, you know, revamp of the iOS as part of the new layout of iTunes, and perhaps it didn't make as much of a big deal of it as we would have thought, considering that the company has had such a big play in music over the last 10 years or so. And so, first of all, I wanted to ask you, you know, did you feel like the announcement was understated or underwhelming in the way that they deliver the iTunes Radio announcement, Jim?
It's hard to know. I mean, it was like, yeah, I thought the keynote in general was fairly ballsy. You know, I mean, they kind of came out and they went womp womp womp. Here you go. You think we're bitches? You think we're going to laying down? Well, this is what we got planned. I thought the new Mac Pro looked amazing. I mean, I want that on my desktop. But when it comes out, it looks incredible. Whether I'd use it for anything other than a goldfish bowl, I don't know. But
I want it in my backpack.
But the thing about like me iTunes Radio though is that I suppose you got to remember this is the first iteration in a long step. We've been waiting a long time to hear Apple do anything like this. And, you know, when you kind of parse it, and you've got to remember that all we're doing right now is extrapolating details from a press release and from an announcement. We actually haven't seen it. We don't know what it looks like. We don't know what the interface is going to be like. You know, we know what the cost is going to be. It's going to be when it's rolled out later on in the year that we're going to see, we're going to find out the real kind of story here. Whether it was kind of like, you know, I think, you know, when it comes to Apple announcements, we kind of expect the sun, the moon, the stars. And like, you know, when they're understated, when they don't give you everything you expect to get. I mean, many people were probably expecting like them to be pitching in, going right up into kind of Spotify's grill from the get-go. That's not been Apple's way, we know from the past. So it's like, in many ways, what they did this week with the announcement was probably a typical Apple play.
Yeah. Alejandro, what was your takeaway from the announcement here?
Well, I didn't expect much from it, and actually, once our colleague in Dublin says that the entire launch was pretty ballsy, but the iTunes Radio thing I found very similar to Pandora. And I think that as the iTunes CEO said a few hours after the launch, there's going to be a bloodbath. I mean, what's interesting is not what's happening right now with the rollout of the application, but what's going to continue to happen afterwards. What kinds of things and consequences will lead after this whole thing happened. You know, the entire thing of Pandora buying a station in South Dakota, I found very interesting yesterday, and I found like it's part of that bloodbath that the TuneIn CEO said was going to be unleashed after this whole release was happening. But in terms of radio and online radio and how this whole big mess is turning out, I didn't find it very appealing or interesting, particularly because I'm not a Mac user. So, you know, I guess we'll have to wait and see what's going to happen.
Sure. Clyde, what was your takeaway from the keynote?
Well, I'm thinking about what both these guys just said. Pretty interesting stuff. You know, there were a lot. I mean, Apple had a lot to announce. And but I think maybe I see what you mean about possibly downplaying it a bit. For me personally, I guess it's not just for Mac users, right? Because isn't iTunes available for other platforms, right? So, yeah. I mean, the thing that struck me is that one day I'm going to fire up iTunes, and suddenly there'll be iTunes Radio sitting right there.
Yeah,
and that's kind of that's Apple's big advantage. They're on so many people's computers; they won't have to sign up for anything new. It's already, people are already kind of tied into that because iTunes is a nice product. I've been pretty happy with it. I'm able to buy stuff, put it on there. You know, I burn my CDs that I purchased, of course, and have them all in one space. You know, I get these mixtapes for free. I get, you know, people giving all this free music. That all goes into iTunes. So just adding iTunes Radio to the mix, as somebody who uses iTunes regularly, to me, that's the most powerful thing, is it's just going to be dropped right into the mix and be good to go.
Yeah, and I was thinking about the difference with the Google Play, which is, you know, that you might have the Google All Access Music service on hundreds of millions of phones out there, but who is actually going to do the step of actually paying for it or subscribing to it? Whilst if you have an iOS device, you just turn that on and it's going to have that service just built in, and you won't have to do anything about it. So that's pretty powerful, I think.
And the pricing too. Sorry, just quickly, the pricing. Yeah. It's what, under $25 a year.
Just $25 a year, yeah.
And if to go no ads, and then you have iTunes Match. I mean, you get iTunes Match plus iRadio. It's almost like some of these moves Amazon's been making with, you know, offering their shipping deal. We have that in the States. I don't know if they do that anywhere else. We have Amazon Prime. You pay an annual fee to get 2-day shipping with no additional charge when you get that. And then they added their streaming video service to that for free.
Yeah.
So this ability to, once these big guys have established something, the ability to keep iterating and offering extra things is really powerful.
Yeah. And Alejandro, you were mentioning earlier TuneIn. It's an interesting thing, actually, that Apple has always had the ability to play radio streams right from iTunes, but that's always kind of been downplayed or, you know, kind of hidden there. You know, they could have easily become TuneIn themselves if they wanted to incorporate that type of discovery of radio stations on the platform, but they never did. Why do you think Apple was never that keen on having traditional radio stations on the system?
I'm not really sure. You know, I think that ideas jump from man to man, like the sentence says, like the quote says, and, you know, one of those men grab the idea and turn it into a reality. I think that iTunes is very innovative, very hands-on, and I don't know if you'd agree with me on the fact that every single thing that comes out of Apple tends to focus the users and the consumers' attention on its mobile product, on the iPhone, on solidifying it, on making it stronger. Therefore, the entire iTunes Radio thing, I believe, is very attached to that whole idea that music is a part of your mobile environment and of your mobile life. But I don't think that they were that smart or that clever or actually thought about the idea of aggregating stations and making it simpler for the user in terms of mobile. I myself have never used radio on an iPhone. I did have an iPhone a year ago, and then I switched to Android. But, you know, what I think is TuneIn just jumped in that idea, and they made it possible for people to have, you know, 75 million stations on a mobile handset, and that's pretty much the big difference and the reason why, you know, Apple's not there. Why they haven't, you know, developed further the idea and tried to compete with the TuneIn, right up front, I'm not really sure. I wouldn't be able to tell you, sure. But I do believe that the entire iTunes Radio thing is just a way to lure more consumers into buying mobile handsets, more iPhones for them. I think that's going to make them really competitive and real edgy in these times of streaming.
Yeah, and just to stay with you for a second, I wanted to ask you about what's happening in South America, because of course iTunes has only been around as a national store for music for the past 12 months or so, or just less. So I wanted to ask you, what's your feeling about the adoption of the service and what people are making of it? Because of course, in the US, the MP3 market is already very mature, and that's why Apple has to get into the streaming business, because they need to sort of revitalize the sales of MP3s as well and make sure that people still have it firmly in their mind. But in South America, what is happening for you and in Colombia specifically?
Well, Colombia is just getting started into the entire mobile revolution. As you said, iTunes just came in about a year ago, and things are looking up. You know, the consumer is very, I would say that he's very grateful for the fact that he can now download songs via his mobile, via his iTunes account on his desktop computer and whatnot. But it's still a matter of, consumers who have money, consumers who are able to have a good credit history, consumers who have access to a credit card. That it's not a very massive medium. Yeah. Therefore, even though the major labels are very happy with what's going on and it's been able to give a lot of traction to the entire international frontline Anglo artists, which were pretty much out of the picture because this is a very tropical zone and local artists rule on the radio. Well, now international artists have a possibility to be selling their stuff, whereas when we were doing the whole CD thing, people just didn't have enough money to go out and they weren't really interested in going out and buying, a Nicki Minaj CD or a Maroon 5 CD. Now people can actually go in there and buy a track. They don't have to buy the entire CD. So things are looking up. It's looking pretty interesting. We're going to see if iTunes makes the decision to get the car and put them on the grocery stores and stuff and like the gift cards, and that would give it much more traction, since this is a very poor population. It's not we have a pretty interesting high class system going on, and I would say it's 25% of the population, and then the rest it's middle class or low class people who don't really have access or are not really interested or maybe very trepidatious of using the system right now because of the entire credit card fraud. So things are looking up. It's going to be an interesting deal. Now with the whole thing of Deezer and streaming coming in, it looks even more interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And Jim, just to close on Apple, I want to talk about data. So what is your feeling about, Apple is talking about, 575 million accounts, most with credit cards. Also, they've had the Genius feature and, they've been able to monitor what people are playing on iTunes for years now. So huge backlog of data. Of course, we don't know how they've organized it or what kind of history they've kept track of over the years. But
I mean, if you want to know that, just ask the NSA. They've probably got that. They've probably got a special...
That story has to work itself in everything, doesn't it?
It should right now.
It's a very interesting point, Andrea, about data, and especially kind of going on to something that the other two lads have been talking about as well, is that you also got to remember where Apple are going to go with this, because as you're talking about, say, the MP3 market in the States, the pay for download market maturing, right? If something like this matures and more of the mainstream, let's forget about ordinary music fans, or serious music fans, let's talk about ordinary music fans, those Maroon 5 fans, those are mainstream music fans, as they get more and more hip to streaming and relies on money they can save from streaming. Someone like Apple are going to be looking at dilution of revenue on two or three different fronts. First of all, it's going to be the dilution in terms of loss of revenue from the iTunes store for those 99-cent downloads. Second of all, is we've seen the death now of the iPod market. The iPod is gone, so it's over. So if they want to sell more gadgets, which we all know is Apple's basically bottom line in all this, if they want to sell more iPhones, whatever, they've got to build things into that. Are we going to see them doing things like iTunes Radio, like Nokia's come with music, for example? This is what I'm saying about this move with iTunes, with iTunes and Apple, it's the first step. They are, as Mark Mulligan was pointing out in his blog post this week, they are a cautious company, which you can bet that they've mapped out in their heads where all of this is going to go. And as you're saying, 575 million accounts with credit cards attached, that's a serious number that's a serious amount of people who are will immediately look at something like this for $25 a year as well. That's a pretty good price point as well, compared to Spotify or Deezer. And it's also very interesting that most of the consumer press leading on this
hasn't really kind of copped the fact that we're talking about radio here. We're not. They seem to kind of like, it seems to be a kind of a complication or kind of a, I suppose, a deliberate misunderstanding that like iTunes Radio has been seen almost like a streaming service like Spotify or like Deezer. It's not really, we're talking about hundreds of radio channels, which, I mean, when it sounds, when you think about hundreds of radio channels, things, you think that's quite a lot. But when you look at the fact that something like Spotify or Deezer have got millions and millions of tracks that people can access that easily, it remains to be seen where this is going to go. But I think given what Apple have, given the ease of use of their products, I mean, like, you know, like even if you're not very technical, like my 70-something-year-old mother, she picks up an Apple product, she can use it straight out of the box. They're so intuitive. They've got that mainstream audience already tapped into, and something like iTunes Radio is just going to be gangbusters to this crowd.
Yeah. And Clyde, anything further to add on data, or are you good?
No, I think that wrapped it. Jim wrapped it up really well.
Awesome. And so,
is it going to be, I just got a question.
Yeah, sure.
Don't you guys get the feeling that the entire streaming thing is kind of like, I was reading something about this yesterday on some techie blog, but don't you get the feeling that maybe people are getting confused with the entire new radio thing on digital? I mean, it's like what you were saying a minute ago. I agree with you on that. I mean, the iTunes thing is pretty powerful. They got the 400 million credit card database, which is it's definitely huge. They're going to make it easier for people to get closer to their music and to be able to stream it. But I just still think that, you know, these are streaming services and we're calling it radio. Why are we calling it radio, you know? It doesn't seem like radio to me at all, you know?
Yeah. And finally, Jay-Z had a big impact on DMT's timeline over the past few weeks, thanks to his partnership with Samsung for the release of Magna Carta Holy Grail. And on DMT 137, I talked with Jay Herskowitz, Jeff Price, and Marcus Taylor after the announcement. You know, a marketing story for once. So this Sunday, Samsung aired a 3-minute advert during the NBA final announcing the release of Jay-Z's latest album called Magna Carta Holy Grail, which will be available for free for 1 million Samsung device owners 3 days before the official release via a dedicated app on the Google Play Store. So this is an interesting deal, and reportedly Jay-Z is getting paid $5 for each of these downloads, so $5 million in total. You know, in the past couple of days, we've seen a lot of articles come out in terms of what does this mean? Does this change your relationship between artists and brands? Is this a new type of sort of patron of the arts model of the 21st century? And we've seen a lot of arguments flying back and forth. But first of all, I want to concentrate on the actual deal and the setup and how it may affect the album release. So do you think this will work in Jay-Z's favor from a marketing point of view? Jay, do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great deal for Jay-Z. I mean, one, he gets all the money in his pocket up front. Two, it gets everyone talking about it. You know, he got that 3-minute spot during the NBA Finals. I don't know how much that cost, but it certainly wasn't cheap. I think it's a definite win for Jay-Z. For Samsung, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But you know, it's similar. I think a lot of people were talking about the similarity between this deal and what Prince did with the Daily Mail cover mount.
Right.
I don't know how many years ago that was, but it'll be interesting to see how this plays versus that. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. And Jeff, from your perspective, you know, having worked on a lot of independent releases, how do you see this playing out as a massive giveaway?
Well, music—the means to the end with music used to be to sell it. You'd make money when the music sold. Now, music is a means to a different end. It's either selling hardware, software, market share, or something else. Samsung has to pay a cost of customer acquisition. It costs them X amount of dollars to go out and acquire someone to buy a Samsung product. So does it cost them less than $5 per unit, or what's their cost to acquire a new customer? Jay-Z is a vehicle to help them acquire customers, and Jay-Z has a better megaphone to reach people than Samsung does because Jay-Z has a more intimate brand. So by paying Jay-Z money, Jay-Z becomes the mouthpiece for Samsung for customer acquisition, using his music as the vehicle to do so. I mean, that's what it is. And for Jay-Z, it's freaking great. Money in his pocket up front. Yeah. Does Jay-Z control the masters on this particular album?
Well, that was the thing that I was wondering when I was reading all these articles, because I know that Roc Nation is his label, but it's distributed by Universal, so I'm not sure what kind of slice Universal would get through this deal, if any at all.
Well, if he's signed to Universal, then the payment's made to Universal, not to Jay-Z, and then Jay-Z has some split that's being done with Universal. But ultimately, music is now the vehicle that's being used by companies to achieve another end. And, you know, companies are the new record labels. They have pipelines, they have advertisements, they have people that follow them, and if they had access to distribution and access to master recordings, they can repurpose those, promote the artist, and at the same time acquire new customers and up their brand through association.
Yeah. Yeah, and Marcus, so what's your take from a marketing perspective? Do you think this works? You know, you work with brands a lot as well, so that's interesting to hear your perspective on this.
Yeah, I actually really like this one in particular. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out for Samsung, but
yeah.
I mean, my initial thoughts, it looks like a really good deal on Jay-Z's behalf, but I think also the association with Jay-Z that Samsung are going to be getting, as well as kind of, you know, if a lot of Jay-Z fans, are going to get this device on the basis that they'll then be the first people to get the album. That's something I'm a little bit unsure about, but if that does happen, then I think that would be very impressive.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think there's going to be a huge number of people that are going to run out and grab a Samsung phone between now and the time that the album's released with the specific, you know, goal of getting that album up front. But from a brand halo perspective, you know, it is one thing that a Samsung owner has now to kind of hang over the head of an iPhone owner. So I think that's probably, it's not as measurable, but probably as much of the goal as actually moving devices between now and, I don't even know when it comes out, next week?
It's the 4th of, I think it was Independence Day.
4th of July,
of July, yeah.
A couple weeks, yeah.
I mean, if you think about it this way, $5 million for the branding, the Halo Association that you've just described is that's pocket change for Samsung. How else could they could have done a $5 million media buy, which would have been, I don't know, how many spots? Or think of the way this thing's just going to ripple virally and through blogs and Twitter spheres and sharing and so on. So a $5 million buy for this amount of branding and notoriety is a great deal.
Yeah, it's an interesting deal actually as well, because if the money is being paid for the recording, for the album itself, then there is a whole host of people that are going to get paid through this deal, and not just Jay-Z. Whilst Jay-Z could have quite as easily decided to do just a personality deal and gotten probably the same amount of money, but keeping all that money himself, essentially. So,
well, he's getting both now.
Yeah.
Right? Jay-Z monetizes his fame. Traditionally, they did it by selling music, but now with disintermediation and technology, there's new ways to monetize your fame. And, you know, he's getting the best of both worlds. He's getting the personality branding while simultaneously generating revenue through something he created, his music, right? He gets two for one.
Yeah. And Jay, does it sound like a lot just in terms of numbers? 1 million, as far as I can tell, these are restricted to US devices. It sounds like a lot of copies to be given out. And because you have to actually have an active path between the user actually coming to know about what's happening, and them going to search for the app on the Play Store and actually downloading it and having the album on their phone. It sounds like there's a lot of steps and a lot of awareness that has to be made on Samsung's part. And I almost feel like if it's just US only, like, are they going to be able to give away a million albums?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think they'll have a problem giving away a million albums. I am really interested in what the user experience is going to be for it. And, you know, it sounds like you're going to have to download an app to download the album, which, you know, is not seamless, but it's not terrible given the fact that you can then listen to the album within the whatever media player on your phone that you're already using, as opposed to having a dedicated app to stream only that album.
Yeah.
So I don't think it will be that bad. You know, people always talk about the friction of downloading apps, but how many millions of apps are downloaded every day? It's a little bit of a pain, but I don't think it's going to stop people from getting a free album.
Yeah, sure.
It's funny. I'm thinking about the way it used to be and how quickly we get our tolerance level changes, right? It used to be we would get a coupon that we'd have to drive to Tower Records to redeem and then drive back and put it into our CD player, right? Now it's like, oh, shoot, I have to click a button and download an app.
Right.
And Marcus, in terms of charts, like that's one of the points that people have made, is the fact that these sales are not going to be eligible. Do you think that artists don't care as much about charts anymore, and that's why Jay-Z was happy to go with this deal?
I hadn't really put too much thought into the charting side of it, but I mean, I guess from Jay-Z's perspective, if he's, if he's getting all of this branding from it and getting, the million sales pre-ordered, then, and on top of all the kind of publicity that's going to go around this, I think, you know, if that ripple effect that can then cause will sort of drive other sales and kind of stuff elsewhere, then, you know, I think then that's kind of, it kind of outweighs if he were to do it in a kind of traditional release.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
It also shows the irrelevancy of charts, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be interesting to see how cannibalistic it is from the charting data, but I think it's not going to have that big of an adverse effect to how it's going to chart when it releases anyway, because A, everyone's going to be talking about it, all the Samsung owners are going to be talking about it, so as soon as it hits streaming services, everyone's going to listen to it there, so it's going to hit to the top of the streaming charts. It'll be interesting to see what it does in the download charts, but yeah. I think it's still going to do extremely well there. Not that that's a stretch to say for Jay-Z, yeah, but exactly.
And on DMT 138, I talked with Darren Hemmings and Tom Satchell about Jay-Z's release approach versus Kanye's. And I wanted to go back to what we talked about last week, actually. We talked about the Jay-Z and Samsung deal. And there was an interesting article by Zach O'Malley from Forbes, which looked at this Jay-Z release and the Kanye West release. And he suggests an interesting point, which is that Jay-Z has essentially been paid $5 million to leak his own record, something that would have probably happened anyway, like it happened with Kanye. But the only difference is that Kanye didn't get the $5 million from it. So what do you guys think about that? Can the giveaway by Samsung be compared to a pre-release leak? And do you think in that vein, are we going to see more of these? And do you think it's a business savvy proposition for major artists to do? Because, you know, they kind of have to resign themselves to the fact that once they start distributing the record to digital stores, unless they have like a ridiculous embargo in place, the record is going to leak at least, you know, 2 or 3 days before release. Tom, what's your take?
I thought it was an interesting article at first. I didn't consider it that way. I didn't consider it a leak. I just thought it was a business partnership. As a major artist, you can't hurt Jay-Z. He's already considered a commercially successful artist. So, you know, he's partnered with brands before. So it's not something out of the norm for him.
Sure.
So you know, if he's done is take control back. You know, if it was going to leak, you know, it might have done. We don't know, but all he's done is take control of the situation, and he's done really well out of it. You know, whether Kanye's kicking himself for not doing the same thing is, you know, we don't know. But you know, it's not something that's entirely new. You know, I know we're going to talk about BitTorrent later, but you know, Public Enemy and Counting Crows, you know, a few people have partnered with different sites to, you know, not to essentially leak it, but to distribute it in a different way,
yeah.
For free. So it's just a different way of doing it. But Jay-Z's just made sure he's been paid for it.
Yeah, Darren, do you think it's comparable to a leak? And do you think at this point, you know, it's going to happen anyway? You might as well monetize it and make sure that fans don't want to get it.
I think everyone's getting a bit sort of drunk on the nomenclature around this. It's kind of whether it's a leak, whether it's an exclusive, is a bit, you know, you're talking about getting stuff maybe ahead of its official touchdown date through one means or another.
Yeah.
So kind of, you know, whether it's a paid leak is, that's an exclusive, isn't it? That's not a leak.
Exactly.
A leak is,
yeah,
like you didn't plan it. A leak is we had no idea someone else has taken our record and put it out.
Yeah,
so the notion of like it being a paid leak is a bit weird, frankly,
but
it's sort of a paradox. It makes sense. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting, that whole debate. I think it's it kind of, you know, I talked about this on you know, with the Daily Digest. I've written a few bits about it, and David Emery at Beggars kind of wrote a blog post as a consequence of that that was really good, you know, and I suspect you might have mentioned it last week, but you know, it's worth a read on his site.
I don't think it was out when we recorded it. So.
Oh, right, okay. So, you know, and he was sort of saying, you know, at what point are you kind of selling out and going too far? Because his view was really, I think, that this felt like a step too far. And, I mean, it's funny with David, because me and him often disagree on stuff, but then realise that, or I certainly realise, he might disagree again, that, you know, you meet sort of somewhere in the middle, really. You know, his view is that this is probably a step too far. My view is that, you know, as Tom said, it's kind of like for Jay-Z, he's done so much stuff around brands, and there's so much kind of entrenched business as an element of your culture within hip hop that, you know, it just doesn't seem that weird to me. You know, the notion that he's done this, I don't think his fans would be sat there going, oh my God, he's done what? But equally, like if Radiohead did it, then, you know, you would know full well that fans would be absolutely up in arms.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's complicated. There's never a kind of cut and dried element to this. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, if you can do it and you can get away with it, which I think Jay-Z can, then why not? You know what I mean? It's a great way to monetize. You know, you're basically selling like a million or whatever records kind of up front and getting the cash straight in your pocket. So, yeah. You know, tricky one. But, yeah, as for this kind of notion of it being like a paid leap, that's a bit weird. You know, by the same notion, that's like Daft Punk did a leak to Apple for a week before release. And like, where does this, you know, Alt-J did a SoundCloud leak a week before their album came out.
Yeah.
Where does it stop? You know, that's a bit weird. It's just, we're playing with words.
I guess it's just a question of controlling the source of where that stuff comes out from. I guess
I mean, it, you know, you, but you know, everyone likes to think that they do control the source.
Because I guess it's easier.
And most do, you know.
Yeah, because I guess it's easier, you know, if you start streaming your album on iTunes a week before release, then thinking about it from a digital release perspective, then you could actually only start sending the album to all the other stores, you know, the day after you start the streaming on iTunes, and so that means that, you know, even if you did have a leak from one of those stores, which, you know, there's hundreds in the world, it's very hard to control what happens with the files after you send them, then it means that at least the people have a one place where they know that they can get it anyway and listen to it anyway, and they're less interested in the leak itself. That's the only benefit.
I think really this to me boils down to, you know, giving, you know, trying to understand what fans want and when, and then balancing that against, you know, the potential revenue to be drawn from that, and whether it's going to piss the fans off. You know, if you sit there and go, oh, you know, someone's going to pay me 10 million quid to shoot my CD to the moon and leave it there for a week before release, I'll do that. You know what I mean? And that's not very wise. But, like, you know, with the Jay-Z Samsung thing, it's funny because, like, you know, there's a lot of people using Samsung devices. And it's funny because I may be off on it, but I think, you know, a lot of music industry people use Apples and, you know, and iPhones as products. And it's kind of the people I saw grumbling hardest about this, I would stake a lot of money on owning an iPhone. And sometimes that can make you a bit myopic as to the broader deal of, like, the man in the street. And I think, you know, Samsung are selling an absolute ton of these things. Yeah. You know, and they're free to Samsung device owners. Have you seen how many Samsung devices are out there? There's about 30. You know, everyone thinks there's like one handset. There's not. There's like a raft of these things. So there's a huge potential reach.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I just think, to be honest, you know, as I said, in hip-hop generally, it's kind of, you know, if you haven't launched like a clothing line and a vodka brand, then you're clearly not doing very well. So in that world, kind of releasing stuff, you know, in advance to Samsung owners is kind of de rigueur. You know, it's to be expected. And I just think other fans will wait. And you know what? If someone leaks it and then it winds up all over peer-to-peer as a result, then maybe that's the backlash, and that's the indication that maybe you did go a bit too far with this one and you should reconsider in future, you know, because it could be that it does leak and everyone rushes in, you know, in their bid to get it because it's locked out for non-Samsung device owners, you know, that then it gets downloaded a load of times and doesn't get sales, you know, things like that. So we'll see. But I think I have to say, actually, another part of this that I think hasn't really had much debate yet is the degree to which his option to use Samsung within, you know, his campaign will potentially damage his chances of getting kind of love from iTunes, for example, and things like that. Like, to what extent would other retailers get behind this, knowing that he's taken it to, certainly in the case of Apple, like the number one kind of competitor at the moment, you know? And I my gut feeling is that I suspect iTunes will just sort of man up and put it on a brick on the front, because they know that it is guaranteed to sell an absolute ton of stuff. So only a fool would ignore it. It's a business transaction at the end of the day. But even so, that's sort of something I've not seen much mention of, is like, to what extent has that exclusivity damaged his relationship with other retailers.
And on DMT 141, we looked at the results of the Jay-Z campaign with Eric Eitel and Andrea Grutzke, Duncan Gier, Martin Davies, and Darren Hemmings. This week, I hope that we end the coverage of the Jay-Z Magna Carta Holy Grail industry side of things with the results of the first week sales. And so the results are in, and they beat all expectations, catapulting Magna Carta Holy Grail to the second highest week one seller in the US, behind only Justin Timberlake. So the album sold 527,000 copies in the first week. Of course, it's more than half, it's just more than half of what Timberlake scored, but it's a lot more than what, for example, Daft Punk did, who were currently in the second place with 339,000 copies sold in the first week. So on top of that, Forbes reports that the album has beaten Spotify records with 14 million streams in the first week, and according to estimates, this could have earned Jay-Z a further 600K plus or minus, taking into account that most of these plays would have been from the free tier users. So this dissipates, I guess, some of the questions that we all had around cannibalizations deriving from the Samsung partnership and then the giveaway of all those copies of the album on the model itself, and also on the privacy and delivery issues that the Samsung app itself experienced. It doesn't seem like any of those things have actually overall hampered the sort of huge impact of the album across all mediums. So the numbers speak for themselves at this point, and I think that's why I hope that we can draw this story to a close after seeing how well it's done. So do you think this proves that the model is worth pursuing, and we're going to see more of these partnerships crop up in the coming weeks and months? Martin, what are your thoughts on that?
Maybe. You know, it's difficult, right? Because what you're looking at here is, you know, one of the world's biggest artists releasing releasing a good album after not having had one out for a while. It was always going to do well, right? There was no way around that. I think it's difficult to say whether, you know, the medium by which it was originally released and the Samsung, you know, hold over that and the free copies available, you know, that wasn't necessarily going to hamper it, because at the end of the day, this is a huge artist putting out a huge release with an immense amount of publicity and hype around it.
Yeah.
I don't think that it's also it's not a good case study in that sense, because there's very little to draw away from it. If you were to do this with, you know, an artist, like, you know, could you do this with an unknown artist? Absolutely not.
Oh, no, of course. Right? No.
Could you do it with, like, a middling tier artist, or, you know, someone that's never really sold records outside of the UK, maybe never got a record past the top 20 before? Possibly. I think at the end of the day, you know, if you're going to go with multimedia over a couple of weeks worth of promotion, you know, it's going to shift units somewhere. You know, giving it away for free in a time with a mobile application, it's going to work for some, it won't work for others. There are only certain artists that are going to be able to put that amount of weight behind doing this in the first place. When I was at Universal, we tried to do this quite often, and frankly, the numbers just never stacked up for the majority of people that we looked at it for. You know, if you've got a partner like Samsung, which in no doubt they were absolutely happy to throw a ton of money at this in the first place, then sure, that's going to work. But you know, outside of that, no, I don't think so. But in that sense, I think when you're an artist of this scale, you certainly aren't going to be hampered by giving it away for free, you know, on some phones.
Yeah, sure. And that's what I said last week. I mean, last week I said that if this was going to go well for Jay-Z, it may result in seeing perhaps 3, 4, 5 tops campaigns of this type a year for really major artists, if they can get the deals in place and they have a huge release coming out that might work. But I think we'd struggle to see it happening for more. Darren, same thing for you. I would imagine that even if you work with a pretty big artist as well, this wouldn't really work for them. It'd have to be a very specific type of artist, like Rihanna or Beyonce or Jay-Z or maybe Lil Wayne or something.
Yeah, I mean, as Martin said, there's a few factors that sort of add to it in the same manner as Daft Punk, David Bowie and Justin Timberlake, where they've all been away for a good while, and then they, you know, come back. And there's a couple of interesting things I thought around the Jay-Z campaign. Particularly notable was that there was no lead single. It was just put out there, which I thought was something people slightly missed. But I think actually the whole app download thing is sort of mistaking the bigger picture, which was that, you know, by doing this gigantic deal with Samsung, it guaranteed like millions being spent on advertising that left the label, you know, that was entirely free of the label's own budget.
Yeah.
Well, Samsung were bankrolling all of those ads in the States that ran on primetime TV to hundreds of millions of people. And they were paying for all of that. So the whole thing is, when you do these deals, it just augments his budget to kind of biblical proportions.
Yeah.
So that by that point, you better hope he gets some serious sales off the back of it, because the money spent on it, whilst not the label's money entirely, is still a massive amount of money. You know, if you were to do that on any other level where the label alone was spending it, there'd probably be a sort of profit and loss bloodbath, you know, because you've got to account for this stuff. So
it's an interesting model, but yeah, as Martin said, I don't think you can take a massive amount from it. I mean, it's just an exceptional thing for a fairly exceptional artist, and so I'm not really going to sit here, you know, poring over it too greatly. I'll be more interested to see what the Lady Gaga app does, because I've got a gut feeling that that would die a slow, painful death.
Ooh.
So, yeah, you heard it here first.
Interesting. Well, I hope you managed to hold on until the end of this very long best of show and that you enjoyed it. This best of show covered the episodes from January to July 2013. And if you like digital music trends, please tell a friend, a colleague, or a like-minded digital music geek. Given the show's niche audience, we rely on word of mouth a lot to grow. So I really hope you enjoy the show. Check out digitalmusictrends.com. Check the show out on iTunes, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, Stitcher, and Spreaker. Have a great week, and until next time. And that's all for this week. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Check out digitalmusictrends.com and sign up to the weekly newsletter.